This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating 40 years with the arrival of Anniversary Blend Coffee and Tea. Portland locations on the web at PEETS.com.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villandetos Tiede has more.
I'm Alisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we will bring you the second half of our two-part series on the anti-illegal immigrant movement in Oregon.
Roe's lawyer has been told by prosecutors he won't be charged with any crimes in the investigation into the leak of a CIA officer's identity.
And Mexico is preparing for what is certain to be a severely polarizing election 2 weeks from today.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 13th, 2006. I'm Doug Guidi.
And I'm Jo Sonia Watson. U.S. Army Specialist Susan and Nicole Swift of Eugene was returned to Fort Lewis, Washington today, charged with going AWOL to avoid a second tour of duty in Iraq. Supporters in Eugene held a vigil for her early this morning as military police from Fort Lewis took her into custody and headed up Interstate 5. Eugene police arrested Swift Sunday at her mother's house. According to Eugene police officials, Swift was taken to the Lane County Jail, where she had been held until her transfer to military police and her return to the Army base near Tacoma. Swift, age 21, serves in a military police unit. Her mother, interviewed last night on KBOO Evening News, said Swift suffers from post-traumatic stress syndrome, in part from repeated sexual harassment by her fellow officers. Swift is the second U.S. Army soldier to refuse redeployment in as many weeks. Last week, Lieutenant Aaron Watada of the Army Striker Brigade was taken into custody. Officials said he would be shipped out with his brigade. Fort Lewis Army spokesman said Joe Watt said that the Swift's company commander will determine the punishment and that no decision had been made.
Prison authorities said this week 50 inmates at Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution in Pendleton were transferred to other state prisons following an inmate fight. Prison spokesman Doug Harder said the nature of the violence suggests it was gang-related. The fight was among a few inmates and quickly escalated to include about 60 inmates. It ended with an officer firing a warning shot into a sandbox in the yard. Harders say there was no evidence of weapons being used in the brawl.
Governor Ted Kulongowski, Senate President Peter Courtney, and House Speaker Karen Minas today announced a proposed restructure of Oregon's mental health system that includes constructing several new state hospital facilities. The proposal calls for one 620-bed facility in the North Willamette Valley region, one 360-bed facility south of Linn County on the west side of the Cascades, and at least two non-hospital-level 16-bed secured residential treatment settings east of the Cascades. The public will be offered opportunities to comment on the proposal during the next several weeks. Final decisions about the facility location, design, and financing will be made by the close of the 2007 legislative session. One public input has been received and evaluated, and the Department of Administrative Services has approved an inventory of potential sites.
Oregon State Hospital workers are launching an effort to safeguard the ashes of patients who died under state care as public officials consider plans for a permanent resting place. The patient remains are currently stored in thousands of fragile copper cans. The decaying urns hold the ashes of patients who died at the psychiatric facility between the late 1880s and the mid-1970s. During that time, any ashes not claimed by families of deceased patients were stored in sealed canisters. For decades, the cans slowly rotted in the darkness of a dusty storage room. But after recent media reports, the urns have become a symbol of the fight for better mental health care.
Electronic files containing personal data of up to 2,200 Oregon taxpayers may have been compromised by an ex-employee's unauthorized use of a computer, the Oregon Department of Revenue said today. Officials said the incident apparently occurred when an employee downloaded a contaminated file from a porn site. The Trojan attached to the file may have sent taxpayer information back to the source when the computer was turned on. Hardin said the released data likely involved names and addresses or social security numbers, or possibly in some cases all three. It's unclear if it was damaging, but said some of the data may have gotten back to the porn site. About 1,600 files have been identified so far, and the total likely will not surpass 2,200, officials said. 1,300 letters have been sent out to the affected taxpayers as of Monday night, and the rest are being contacted as they are identified.
Yesterday, we heard from anti-immigration ralliers and the 21st century Paul Revere riders. The riders, who are in Carson City, Nevada today, are crossing the country by motorcycle, warning of the dangers posed by immigration. They link immigrants to terrorism, crime, and disease. In part two of the series, KBOO's Jacob Fenson examines some of the arguments against immigration.
Undocumented immigrants pay little or nothing in taxes, the argument goes, and get billions of dollars in government services.
So one of the reasons why our school systems are in such bad shape, obviously our infrastructure, whether it's housing, roads, health care, is all going to be compromised if we allow in 66 to 90 million poorly educated, unskilled people.
That's Jim Ludwig, president of Oregonians for Immigration Reform.
There's this whole myth that's out there that says that immigrants come into the country, they go to the welfare office, get cut a check.
Ramon Ramirez, president of Oregon's farm worker union, PECUN.
They go to an unemployment office and they get unemployment benefits. They use food stamps, health care, and all the like. But it's a lie. I mean, for a lot of us that work with immigrants, we know that it's difficult for even legal residents and U.S. citizens to get benefits.
According to a recent report by the Oregon Center for Public Policy, Oregon's undocumented workers pay between $137 and $160 million in state Social Security and Medicare taxes. In addition, Oregon employers pay as much as $117 million in taxes on behalf of those workers.
For somebody to come out and use some type of mathematical figuring to assume that people pay taxes when they don't is outrageous.
Jim Ludwig. He cites a hypothetical tax return he worked out with a CPA. Ludwig based the tax return on what he says is a typical undocumented family, a couple with two children making $15,000 a year.
At that rate, they pay zero in federal taxes, but receive $4,400 as an earned income tax credit. So they pay no taxes, but on top of that, they get $4,400. I'm not going to say back because they never put any in. So they don't pay taxes.
But Mike Leachman, who prepared the OCPP study on undocumented workers, says that assessment is flat out false.
Very few undocumented workers file income taxes. The vast majority who pay income taxes pay them because they're withdrawn from their paycheck. Even the small number who do file their income taxes are not eligible for the earned income tax credit, and the IRS is very diligent about policing the earned income credit to assure that undocumented workers do not get that credit.
Ludwig also blames immigration for overpopulation and damage to the environment. Erica Steinbauer with immigrant advocacy group CAUSA says Ludwig's argument about environmental sustainability is a wedge strategy cloaked in progressive language.
I think that if they were really so concerned about the environment, then they could look at things like the pollution from U.S. companies around the world. And if they were really so concerned about things like overpopulation, they could look at things like women's access to reproductive health care. I don't think that attacking undocumented immigrants is the best way to go about solving the environmental crisis.
Another argument is that immigrant labor forces down wages. Oregon State Representative Jeff Kropf explained this argument to me at the rally on Friday.
All the cheap labor for framing houses and roofing houses and drywalling and so forth, that hasn't lowered the cost of homes to us, the consumers, has it? So it's only enriching employers who employ illegal people. We've got to stop that, because ultimately it will make America a third world country, and I'm not willing to see that happen.
I asked him if free trade agreements increase immigration.
They absolutely do. There's no question about that. That's a correlation that's been drawn through studies. And I think it's one of the unfortunate consequences of this worldwide movement towards free trade. Now, I'm a believer in the capitalist model. I'm a believer in free trading. However, free trade has to be fair trade.
By fair trade, he means fair to the United States. What is unfair about the current trade policy is that employers in the U.S. are encouraged to hire foreign workers at lower wages than they would pay to U.S. citizens. The U.S. should only approve trade agreements, says Kropf, if our trade partners make certain economic reforms, like lowering taxes. If Mexico reduces taxes, says Kropf, the middle class will thrive, there will be more jobs at home, and immigrants won't seek work in the United States. The way that the U.S. can help the Mexican economy and stem immigration is to force the Mexican government to lower taxes. Ramon Ramirez agrees that immigration is caused by economic disparities across the hemisphere.
If workers were making a decent wage, a living wage in their home country, they wouldn't come here.
But he doesn't think high taxes are the root of the problem. He says free trade has allowed the U.S. to flood Latin America with cheap products, forcing locals out of business.
This was the case in Zacatecas last year, where they grew the bumper crop of pinot beans, but they hadn't even sold last year's pinot beans. And the reason why is because their own government was actually buying pinot beans from the U.S. at a cheaper price than they would pay for beans grown in Mexico, due in part because the U.S. government was subsidizing, you know, the U.S. farmers to make it cheaper. So what happened is, you know, all those farmers went under. And where are they going to go? You know, they got to eat. They got to work.
I'm Jacob Fenston, KBOO News.
A majority of Oregon State University's College of Forestry has officially voted to support Dean Hall Sulwasser's despite charges of academic censorship against him. Sulwasser admitted trying to quash a student's research that went against timber industry policy on logging after wildfires. The move came before Congress voted to speed up post-fire logging operations in the Pacific Northwest. The university made the announcement today after a committee looked into his conduct following the attempts to delay publication of a study in the prestigious journal Science. The study found logging after the 2002 Biscuit Fire in southwestern Oregon had killed plentiful seedlings that sprouted naturally and left more fuel on the ground for future fires.
Wild monk parrots are rebuilding a nest in a new cell phone tower in Port Orchard. The birds were displaced last year when their previous nest was dismantled. The parrots, also called parakeets, escaped a few years ago from their owner and were able to survive in the wild. At least four of the birds are still around. Some think the birds are a risk to electrical equipment, but others think that chattering birds are a charming addition to their Port Orchard neighborhood.
That beer you're holding may contain small amounts of a compound thought to prevent prostate cancer and enlargement, according to an Oregon State University study. But you'd have to drink almost a case to activate its benefits. Researchers said that Zandvol Hummel, which is found in the hops used to brew beer, belongs to a group of a plant compounds called flavonoids that can trigger the death of cancer cells along the surface of the prostate gland. Fred Stevens, an assistant professor of medical chemistry at OSU's College of Pharmacy, said it may be possible for drug companies to develop pills containing concentrated doses of the flavonoid and to increase the Zandvol Hummel content of hops. The Oregon State findings were published in a recent issue of Cancer Letters. German scientists have already developed beer that contains 10 times the amount of Zandvol Hummel as traditional beers. The drink is being marketed as a healthier beer, but research is still underway to determine if it has any effects on cancer.
The current time is 5:14. Still to come on the KBOO Evening News. The federal district judge overseeing the CIA leak case against Lewis Scooter Libby held a pretrial status hearing today. China is selling arms to human rights abusers, according to a new Amnesty International report. And here now, a 7-year-old Pennsylvanian has swept the nation with his invention, the peanut butter hot dog. You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO, in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
Top White House aide Karl Rove has been told by prosecutors he won't be charged with any crimes in the investigation into leak of a CIA officer's identity, his lawyer said today, lifting a heavy burden from one of President Bush's most trusted advisors. Attorney Robert Luskin said Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald informed him of the decision today, ending months of speculation about the fate of Rove. The architects of Bush's 2004 re-election now focused on stopping Democrats from capturing the House or Senate in this November election. Fitzgerald met with Chief U.S. District Judge Thomas Hogan before he notified Rove. Hogan has been overseeing the grand juries in the CIA leak case. Fitzgerald's spokesman, Randall Sanborn, declined to comment. Fitzgerald has been investigating whether senior administration officials intentionally leak Plame's identity in retribution because her husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, sharply criticized the administration's pursuit of war in Iraq. Rove testified 5 times before a grand jury, most recently in April. He has admitted he spoke with columnist Robert Novak and Time magazine reporter Matt Cooper in the days before they published Plame's name in July 2003.
5 states hold elections today, including a bruising primary battle in Virginia. Virginia Democrats are deciding whether longtime party activist Harris Miller or James Webb, a former Reagan aide who left the Republican Party over the Iraq War, will take on GOP Senator George Allen this fall. Miller and Webb presented the most unusual contrast for a Democratic primary, a traditional and unabashed liberal in Miller against Webb, whose populist campaign was aimed at bringing so-called Reagan Democrats back home. Miller appealed to core Democrats to remain true to party ideals and loyal to him, while Webb enticed them with his ability to win over rural, moderate white people and be George Allen's worst nightmare. Both candidates sought to tie Allen tightly to Bush, particularly over Iraq, noting that last year Allen voted with the unpopular president 97% of the time.
The European Parliament today called for the closure of U.S. prison camps in Guantanamo Bay, saying the fight against terrorism could not be won at the expense of human rights. This comes as 3 prisoners committed suicide, making family members of the other Arab prisoners even more terrified about their sons who are held there without trial. FSRN's correspondent Aman Jordan Ali Farawati met with the family of Ahmad Hassan, one of the detainees.
The suicide of 3 prisoners at Camp 4 in Guantanamo detention camp has sent shivers around the world. Governments and civil society are calling for an independent investigation into the deaths. They are also asking that impartial doctors examine the detainees there. Here in Jordan, worried families of the Jordanian detainees expressed fear and anger at the news, especially that very little information was being leaked about the physical and emotional conditions of the 7 Jordanian detainees currently being held there without trial. The family of Jordanian detainee Ahmed Hassan says they received the news with shock and panic. Hassan's nephew Asad Hamoudi.
We do not understand this anymore. Our grief has reached the limit. Our hands are tied and we are angry. This cannot go on.
Lawyers for the prisoners in Washington said the Bush administration should allow independent medical experts into the camp to examine prisoners. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said the suicide of 3 detainees at the camp were not completely unexpected, and the focus now should be on closing the facility. Separately, the UN Special Investigator for Torture said in Germany that Guantanamo should be closed this year. A good opportunity for announcing the closure would be President George Bush's visit to Austria. In Jordan, however, the government did not comment on the suicide. It recently said that, quote, it was not responsible for the detainees who made a personal decision to leave to Afghanistan, end of quote. This made Hassan's sister in Sharjah even more worried, especially that the few letters she used to receive from her brother, who was detained there some 5 years ago when he was in Afghanistan, stopped coming in.
I have no idea how he is doing. He and his colleagues are being tortured. No one has asked about him, and the government has not talked about it. I don't know why he stopped writing to me.
Also today, Al Jazeera News Channel marked the 50-year anniversary of the detention of its cameraman, the Sudanese Sami Al-Haj, who was detained in Afghanistan. Al Jazeera correspondent Abdul Haq Salah was accompanying Al-Haj.
He was detained erroneously because someone was using his lost passport, and this person had a relation to Al-Qaeda. Sami was surprised because of that and said he had asked the authorities about the loss of his passport, but they never listened to him.
Al Jazeera said the U.S. was ignoring all international calls to close the camp, calling it the most unique prison in history. In Amman, Jordan, I am Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Campaigners have accused the Bush administration of deliberately ignoring mounting evidence of psychological and mental health problems among prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, despite more than 40 previous suicide attempts. Lawyers who represent some of the 460 men at the prison said no one should be surprised by the suicides of three inmates over the weekend. One of them who was 17-year-old when he was incarcerated, and another who was earmarked for transfer. But Bill Goodman, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, has said that the Bush administration has systematically and deliberately denied these men their most basic rights through a policy of choking off all contact, communication, information, and hope. The CCR provided a precise timetable detailing the efforts of campaigners to raise the issue of suicide risk among inmates, as well as the government's tactic acknowledgement of the problem, stretching back to 2002. In 2003, the International Committee of the Red Cross, the only independent organization granted access to the prisoners, warned of the severe mental health issues facing many and said the nature of their incarceration interrogation, including humiliating acts, solitary confinement, temperature extremes, use of forced positions, was a form of torture.
27 leaders, including megachurch pastor Rick Warren, Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel, and Cardinal Theodore E. McCarrick of Washington, have signed a statement urging the United States to abolish torture now without exception. The statement, being published in newspaper advertisement starting today, is the opening salvo of a new organization called the National Religious Campaign Against Torture, which is formed in response to allegations of human rights abuse at U.S. detention centers in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Titled Torture is a Moral Issue, the statement said that torture violates the basic dignity of the human person and contradicts our nation's most cherished values. Nothing less is at stake in the torture abuse crisis than the soul of our nation. What does it signify if torture is condemned, but in word, but allowed in deed, it asked. The signers come from a broad range of denominations and include notable religious conservatives such as Reverend Ted Haggard, president of the National Association of Evangelists, Archbishop Demetrios, primate of the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of America, and Reverend William J. Byron, former president of Catholic University.
A federal appeals court panel in Manhattan questioned a lawyer for the federal government yesterday as to whether the Central Intelligence Agency had a legitimate national security interest in refusing to confirm or deny the existence of documents authorizing it to detain and interrogate terrorism suspects overseas. The tough questioning came in oral arguments by the American Civil Liberties Union and lawyers for the CIA before the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. The Civil Liberties Group is trying to force the CIA to disclose how much authority it has been given to interrogate detainees since the attacks of September 11, 2001. Through the Freedom of Information Act, the ACLU is seeking documents, including a directive said to have been signed by President Bush, giving the agency the authority to set up detention sites outside the United States and to interrogate prisoners. In its lawsuit, the group says the existence of these documents has been hinted at in news reports, but the government has refused to confirm or deny the document's existence, saying that to do so would jeopardize national security by revealing CIA methods and activities.
Hundreds of L.A. County sheriffs stormed a South Central farm at dawn. Campers inside the farm were given just minutes to evacuate. At press time, 7 of the 18 people still inside the farm have been arrested. At least one was taken in an ambulance. Those that remain inside include children, one as young as 1 year old. FSRN's Aura Bogata reports.
Helicopters hovered above the South Central Farm starting at 3:30 a.m. Shortly after 5 a.m., sheriffs began to evict those inside who were camping out. Local campesinos from the South Central area began to arrive as they heard helicopters and police activity near the farm. As tears filled their eyes, some explained how they felt.
Pues en verdad me siento mal porque este era una terapia para nosotros.
She says that the farm was a form of therapy for her and for the community, and that today's eviction is an injustice to humanity. The sale of the land back to the farmers was being negotiated with developer Ralph Horowitz. Last week, the farm announced they had raised the over $60 million asking price and were waiting to hear back from Horowitz. Although today's eviction was a surprise to many, it appears the sheriff's department had been planning the eviction for some time. Val Rosario is a sergeant with the LA County Sheriff's Department.
Well, this operation was very well planned, and they have some maps of the property that assisted us in building an operations plan to safely go through the property and remove people.
Yet the situation inside the farm was chaotic at best during the initial eviction. Amma Jamal explains that although the sheriffs yelled that campers had 10 or 15 minutes to gather their belongings and leave, it seemed like much less.
We're all pretty much asleep. I don't know what happened to the 10 minutes that they were supposed to give us, but it was all pretty hectic inside. But, you know, we're organized. I just wanted to send support to the brothers and sisters inside right now who are keeping the struggle alive. That's why we're standing outside. We're still keeping it up. It's not over until it's over.
Besides the fire department and sheriffs in uniform and riot gear inside the farm, sheriffs, parking enforcement, and L.A. Police Department officers were outside, some armed with rubber bullets, barricading streets. As the sun rose and residents in the South Central community tried to make their way to work this morning, they too faced harassment from the L.A. Police Department. Gerardo was on his way to work this morning when he got caught in a police line.
I was about to go to catch the bus, right? And then once I passed the line, it's like three cops just tackled me, and they said that I can't pass the line instead of tap. So then they just tackled me to the ground, and then they arrested me because supposedly they said that I was like resisting arrest. And I said that all I wanted was just to catch my bus, and that's it.
As the day wore on, supporters began blocking the main street outside the farm. Over 20 were arrested, and several witnesses were badly injured as police used batons to push them away from the site. As bulldozers began to destroy the farm's crops and trees, South Central Farm organizers are asking supporters to head to the LA City Hall in downtown LA, calling for the immediate resignation of Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa. Reporting from the South Central Farm, Amara Bogado with Free Speech Radio News.
The AFL-CIO plans to invest $700 million in housing and other projects to help rebuild New Orleans. The money will come from the Union's Federation's pension fund and its lenders. Investments that should make money for the fund while aiding the reconstruction effort, said AFL-CIO President John Sweeney in an interview today. It also will create union jobs in a region with an enormous number of construction projects. Sweeney said he last visited New Orleans about a month ago and saw tracts of housing left in ruins since Katrina struck almost 1 year ago. He said, quote, "It feels like it's the city that America forgot." The investment plan includes $250 million in financing for housing construction over the next 7 years, with more than 5,000 rental units expected to be built. Another $100 million will be equity investments for commercial real estate and revitalization projects.
A music video posted to the internet telling a tale about a U.S. Marine killing members of an Iraqi family is being condemned by an Islamic group and investigated by the Marine Corps. The 4-minute video called Haji Girl appears to be sung by a Marine in front of a cheering audience. The lyrics talk about the Marine gunning down members of an Iraqi woman's family after they confront him with automatic weapons. The video was posted anonymously on the www.youtube.com website, but was removed. It is still available on Council on American Islamic Relations website. Lieutenant Colonel Scott Fizika, a spokesman for the Marines, said today that the Marines were aware of the video posted on the Internet that, quote, purports to show a Marine singing an insensitive song about Iraqis. Fizika said officials don't know the identity of the singer or whether he is in the military. The song was inappropriate and contrary to the high standard expected of all Marines, Fizika said. He said Marine officers are looking into the matter.
A top House Democrat on Tuesday called on the government to assist up to 26.5 million military personnel whose personal information was stolen, uttering obscenities to say Veterans Affairs officials weren't doing enough. Representative Bob Filner, the acting top Democrat on the House Veterans Affairs Committee, appeared at a news briefing outside the VA building to criticize the agency's three-week delay in publicizing the May 3rd burglary at VA data analyst's home. Earlier in the briefing, Democrats called anew for free credit monitoring for military personnel.
Congress this week is supposed to conduct its most comprehensive debate on the Iraq war since the House and Senate voted to authorize force against Saddam Hussein nearly 4 years ago, with both Democrats and Republicans eager to delineate the party's differences in advance of this fall's congressional elections. The Senate today will begin debate on an amendment that would force President Bush to withdraw nearly all U.S. troops from Iraq by the end of the year. The measure, filed yesterday by Senator John F. Kerry, has no realistic chance of passing, but is designed as an outlet for members of Congress to express themselves about the administration's course of action in the war. The fact that Democrats and Republicans are equally intent on debating the war in Iraq speaks to the volatile and unpredictable politics surrounding it. Public support for the war is sagging, yet many Republicans believe that their party's aggressive national security policy is a strength voters will reward at the polls.
In the Cold War arms race, scientists rushed to build thousands of warheads to counter the Soviet Union. Today, those scientists are racing once again, but this time to rebuild an aging nuclear stockpile. Scientists at Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico are locked in an intense competition with rivals at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in the Bay Area to design the nation's first new nuclear bomb in two decades. The two labs have fiercely competed in the bomb trade with technologies as disparate as Microsoft's and Apple's. The new weapon under development for about a year is designed to ensure long-term reliability of the nation's inventory of bombs. Program backers say that with greater confidence in the quality of its weapons, the nation could draw down its stockpile, estimated at about 6,000 warheads. But some veterans of nuclear arms development are strongly opposed, contending that building new weapons could trigger another arms race with Russia and China, as well as undermine arguments to stop nuclear developments in Iran, North Korea, and elsewhere. And the critics say it would eventually increase pressure to resume underground nuclear testing, which the U.S. halted 14 years ago.
In a surprise move, a House panel voted today for a hike in the minimum wage from $5.15 to $7.25, which would be the first increase in a decade. But the move by the Appropriations Committee as an amendment to a bill funding health and education programs is likely to be stripped out when the measure comes to the House floor. That's because the panel does not officially have jurisdiction over the issue. Also, Representative Howard McKinnon, Republican of California, chairman of the Education and Workforce Committee, said he will strike the provision on the floor. Seven Appropriations Panel Republicans voted with Democrats to approve the wage hike, including John Sweeney and Jim Walsh of New York, Ray LaHood of Illinois, Joanne Emerson of Missouri, and Don Sherwood of Pennsylvania.
The current time is 5:34, and now time for another highfalutin daily commentary from yours truly, Jim Hightower.
Stop the presses. A major discovery has been made. Dennis Hastert, the House Speaker, has shown signs of having a pulse. Surprised experts say this might mean that Hastert is not just a bloated papier-mâché political puppet after all. He might have capacity for independent thought. Dennis, the laconic, doughy, somewhat comical Congress critter from Illinois, was lifted into the Speaker's chair in 1999 by Tom DeLay. Ever since, DeLay and the Bush White House have pulled Dennis's strings and given him his lines, which he dutifully performs. But Dennis recently had a rebellious spasm. What jolted him to life was the FBI's raid of a congressman's office as part of a bribery investigation. This infuriated the normally lifeless Dennis, who complained loudly that breaking into a member's office is an intolerable crossing of the constitutional line that separates the executive and legislative branches. Moving his own mouth, Hastert said he was standing up to sustain Congress's independence from executive power. Holy Thomas Jefferson, what a joke! Hastert and the other congressional leaders, including Democrats, have been total constitutional wimps for the last 5 years as the Bushites rolled over any pretension of legislative independence. For example, Bush has run a massive 4-year spying program against millions of Americans in direct defiance of a law passed by Congress. But not a peep of protest from Dennis about this. Indeed, again and again, congressional leaders have either meekly bowed or enthusiastically applauded as Bush and gang have erected an imperial presidency that emasculates the historical lawmaking and oversight roles of Congress. This is Jim Hightower saying, the Bushites should not be ransacking congressional offices, but that's the least of their imperious intrusions. Until Congress has the spunk to stand up for the rights and liberties of all, don't expect us to weep for Dennis.
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Out Loud. At 7, it's Amanda's Jam Corner. Tonight's weather, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers. Lows around 55. Chance of rain, about 50%. Partly cloudy tomorrow with a chance of showers. High 65 to 70 and about a 20% chance of rain. You are listening to KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
News of Al Zarqai's successor vowing vengeance on the Western world does not come as a surprise to author Randy Hammoud. Hammoud's book is Osama bin Laden, America's Enemy in His Own Words. Hammoud spoke with KBOO's Lisa Loving earlier today.
The U.S. military propagandists inflated the importance of Al Zarqawi in Iraq. There was an article about that in April in the Washington Post, and the purpose of that inflation was to, in one respect, try to drive a wedge between the insurgent groups in Iraq, but also to try to tie more of 9-1-1 to the Iraq theater because Al Zarqawi had declared himself to be an Al-Qaeda member and sympathizer in October of 2004.
Let me go to your book, Osama bin Laden, America's Enemy in His Own Words. When you look at his writings, I think most people in the United States today have never looked at his writings, even though he issues these communiques. Most of us have never heard them, and yet we're all standing by ready to judge him. Just talking about your book a little bit, what would most people think if they picked up Osama bin Laden's writings? Is he a raving Hitler lunatic, or does he come off as being a reasonable thinker, in your opinion?
No, he comes off as a very formidable, logical thinker. He's not a raving maniac, and he doesn't hate freedom. He himself said in one of his statements, if he hated freedom, he would have attacked Sweden. He is alienated by discreet policies of the West, and especially the United States, over the past 50 years plus in the Middle East venue. And he continues to rage about inequities that he perceives to have been suffered by Arabs and Muslims alike in the Middle East venue. And there are discreet policies that he criticizes and that have deep resonance now among the Islamic world and the Arab world relative to U.S. policies. And the policies are very easily identified by him. The United States' bias toward Israel and the Israel-Palestine conflict. The United States' support and Western support for autocratic dictatorial regimes in the Middle East. And United States' support and Western support for countries that repress Muslims. And the one comes to mind that's most mentioned by him is Chechnya, where the Russians, in fact, invaded Chechnya twice, bombed Grozny into the Stone Age, and committed all sorts of brutalities against the Chechens. And now they're depicted as fighting terrorism as part of the alliance against the war on terrorism, meaning against Muslims. So Mr. Bin Laden construes all these activities to mean a new crusade being waged against Islam. And with the Iraq invasion, the Christian army basically invading an Islamic Muslim country that did not present a strategic threat to the United States or to the West, he's getting a lot of deep traction, and they're making more jihadis every day with the Iraq war activities than they're killing by a large measure. It was a very bad move in Iraq. It's become a more effective training ground for jihadis than was Afghanistan for Mr. Bin Laden and his generation of terrorists, because Iraq is an urban venue and they're learning all the techniques of modern urban warfare and all of our countermeasures.
That was author and Arabic language translator Randy Hamoud, editor of the book Osama Bin Laden, America's Enemy in His Own Words.
President Bush made a surprise visit to Baghdad for a meeting with Iraqi ministers. Afterwards, he spoke to American troops, where he told them U.S. troops will remain there until the job is done. Back in the U.S., both House of Congress are gearing up for a debate over the war. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The president was supposed to participate in a teleconference from Camp David with Iraqi ministers, but he surprised Iraqi ministers and most of his own cabinet by attending the conference in Baghdad today.
I've come to not only thank you, but to look Prime Minister Maliki in the eyes, to determine whether or not he is as dedicated to a free Iraq as you are. And I believe he is.
The president stayed in Iraq for about 5 hours, but before leaving, he spoke with American troops. He thanked them for their service, but told them there is more work to be done.
They want to succeed. The fate and future of Iraq is in their hands, and our job is to help them succeed, and we will. I've come today to personally show our nation's commitment to a free Iraq.
The last time the president visited Iraq was in November of 2003. The president hailed the death of al-Qaeda leader in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, but Zarqawi's successor, al-Muhajir, pledged revenge in a statement posted on the Internet. Meanwhile, back in the United States, Iraq is filling Congress's agenda. This week, the Senate is debating the Department of Defense spending authorization bill. The Democrats, though, plan to offer a measure that will provoke a debate on the war. A spokesperson for the Democratic leadership says that if the president doesn't alter his policy in Iraq upon his return from Baghdad, they will offer an amendment that will urge the responsible redeployment of U.S. troops beginning this year. But Democrats' ideas on the handling of the war vary widely. Leaders hope that this amendment will receive the support of the most liberal to the more conservative.
I am convinced that the only way the Iraqis have moved at any time thus far is with a deadline, and I believe we need a hard and fast deadline, not an open-ended commitment of U.S. forces, so that we shift responsibility and demand responsibility from the Iraqis themselves.
Senator John Kerry from Massachusetts has an amendment of his own that would set a complete timetable and deadline for the withdrawal of troops. That's with the agreement of the Iraqi ministry. Addressing a progressive conference called Take Back America, Senator Kerry spoke passionately against the war, comparing it to Vietnam.
We were misled. We were given evidence that was not true. It was wrong, and I was wrong, to vote for that Iraqi war resolution.
Senators Barbara Boxer from California and Russ Feingold from Wisconsin have withdrawal amendments as well. But not all Democrats think U.S. troops should leave Iraq. Senator Hillary Clinton from New York addressing the same conference.
I do not think it is a smart strategy either for the president to continue with his open-ended commitment, which I think does not put enough pressure on the new Iraqi government, nor do I think it is smart strategy to set a date certain. I do not agree that that is in the best interest of our troops or our country.
After Senator Clinton finished speaking, some audience members chanted. They were disappointed in her stance. On Thursday, the House of Representatives will also debate the war, the first since the war began more than 3 years ago. Also in the House, lawmakers passed the $94 billion emergency supplemental, where $70 billion will go to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. $27 billion will go to Hurricane Katrina recovery efforts. A vote on the supplemental is expected in the Senate tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Two Israeli armed strikes in Gaza killed at least 11 Palestinians, including two children, and injured at least 20 others today amidst Palestinian infighting in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. FSRN's Manar Jibrin reports.
An Israeli jet fighter fired two missiles at a Palestinian car thought to be transporting members of the Islamic Jihad. The Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip today killed at least 11 civilians, including two children, and injured some 20 others. A second Israeli missile struck the same location just minutes later, killing at least four paramedics. On Monday, members of Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, the armed wing of Fatah, released a Hamas lawmaker, Khalil Erbaei, whom they abducted earlier in the evening. This came in the wake of the violence that erupted Monday night in the West Bank city of Ramallah, when members of Fatah stormed the buildings of the Palestinian parliament and the prime minister's office in the city and set fire in both. President Abbas had ordered all Palestinian security personnel to go on high alert after clashes erupted in Gaza. A member of the Hamas-controlled executive force was killed in the city of Rafah on Monday. Members of the executive force then surrounded the headquarters of Fatah-led preventive security force. In the ensuing clashes, two were killed and several others were injured. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
Israeli Defense Minister Amir Peretz today denied that Israel was responsible for a blast on the Gaza beach Friday that killed eight Palestinian civilians. At a Tel Aviv news conference to present the findings of an Israeli inquiry into the incident, Peretz said, "We have enough findings to back up the suspicion that the intention to describe this as an Israeli event is simply not correct." Palestinians charged that the deaths were caused by an Israeli artillery shell. Israel military officials said the investigation had concluded that the blast almost certainly came from a Hamas militant mine and not an Israeli shell.
A community of about 500,000 deaf people in Uganda ran a high risk of being infected with HIV/AIDS due to a disproportionate lack of access to information about the disease. As FSRN's Joshua Kalalimpa reports, this is partially due to high illiteracy rates in the deaf community.
Speaking through a sign language interpreter, Florence Mukasa, gender and theater coordinator of the Uganda National Association of the Deaf, UNAD, tells FSRN that 90% of the deaf population in the country cannot write or read compared to people who are not deaf, and some people have been sexually abused.
Uganda National Association of the Deaf, UNAD, has been advocating for equal opportunities of deaf people. It is true that we have had a challenge in accessing information about HIV and AIDS. It has been a big challenge. Why? Because of the education level of deaf people. Most of the deaf people have not been to school, and some of them do not know sign language. And to make it worse, even our parents think that we are not sexually active, we deaf people. So it puts us at a high risk. And also, men think that we are free of the scourge. So most men take advantage and they come to us just for sex. And in any way, we are really at a high risk. And from my experience, when a man proposes to a deaf lady, they never say no. So the end result has been that most deaf people, many have been affected. And because we are in a small community, if one deaf person gets the disease, it spreads it to the others.
The Uganda AIDS Commission says the National HIV/AIDS Program was addressing the AIDS problem from its broader sense and not addressing specific communities such as the deaf community. The spokesman, James Kasozi, says they will invite leaders in the deaf community to find out more about the problem.
There is no deliberate policy to sideline them or to discriminate them in any way. We'll just have to sit down with them and address their concerns specifically. We want to welcome our colleagues, people who are deaf. We want to welcome them to dialogue with us so that we can fill the gaps that they have specifically identified. Because for us, we have been catering for the nation as a whole without discriminating anyone. Once they come up with specific figures, we'll be able to address their concerns.
Uganda is applauded for its successful fight against the AIDS scourge, but the situation for the deaf community is of great concern. The Ugandan National Association of the Deaf says they want to carry out a national sensitization program for the deaf, but they are being held back by the lack of funds.
Many NGOs and many government programs do not remember deaf people. And as we have gone out, deaf people think that AIDS is for the hearing, not us. And most of them, as they get the disease, they're not aware that they have really got the disease. They think it is witchcraft. And most of them are not open. They don't accept that they really have the disease. And we have lost a number of them. So far, now 25 in Kampala have passed away. Those I know. Of course, it is hard to go around and count every deaf person in the whole country.
The plight of the Ugandan deaf is coming after a declaration by a special UN conference marked the 25th anniversary of the month when the HIV pandemic was first diagnosed. UN member countries have committed to work towards universal access to AIDS care by 2010. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Don't try to tell Catherine Bowler yodeling isn't cool. Around Francis Howell Central High School in St. Charles County, the 14-year-old, who just completed her freshman year, was already a celebrity. She won the school's talent competition earlier this year. Even those who don't know her name, she said, still are apt to say, "Hey, it's the yodeler." One student asked her to yodel for his cell phone ringtone. She obliged. Now Bowler is getting national recognition. She recently won the Patsy Montana Yodeling Competition in Pineville, Missouri, a three-day competition drawing yodelers from across the country. Catherine began yodeling a few years ago. During a family trip, the Bowlers heard yodelers perform, and Catherine's mother, Mary, asked if she thought she could do it. It turned out she had the talent. So the Bowlers found a tape on the Internet called "So You Want to Learn How to Yodel." The first step, Catherine said, was to lock all the doors and windows. Why? Because it sounds really bad, Catherine said. But slowly, Catherine learned how to switch between her chest voice and her head voice to produce the unmistakable yodeling sound. So, is a recording in the works? She replied, "I'd love to do that, but it's really expensive."
Tonight, the Cable Evening News bids a bittersweet farewell to Doug Guidi. Doug has volunteered at KABU for 8 years. He'll be in tomorrow to make one last news report, and then he heads to graduate school in public administration in California. Mr. Guidi has filed nearly 100 news reports for KABU News over the years, possibly more. We're going to miss you, man. Thanks to you, Doug Guidi, and we'll see you tomorrow.
That's the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, June 13th, 2006. You're listening to KABU at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at KABU.FM. Our producers for tonight's newscast are Noah Eaton and Angela Hancock Revis. Tonight's audio editor is Angela Hancock Revis. Special thanks to reporters Jacob Fenston and Lisa Loving. Our engineer is Judy Feistel. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Doug Weedy. It's been a pleasure serving you, the KABU listener, for the last 8 years. It's been a great experience and hope to be back. Thank you, and please continue to support KABU News.
Our time has been short, but it's been a pleasure, Doug Weedy. I'm Jo Sonia Watson. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear KABU Morning News at 7:30 a.m. Here, 7:30, Barbara Bernstein hosts Locus Focus Talk Radio. And at 9, it's Movie Talk with Ed, Don, and DK on the latest movies. At 10, on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller addresses the issue of network neutrality with Gene Kinney, a senior policy and now analyst with Consumers Union, and Jeff Chester, the executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your community, nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored radio station. Thanks for joining us.
Independent Native News for Tuesday, the 13th of June. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. The Colorado American Indian Movement has joined another anti-mining campaign on behalf of local communities in Latin America. Colorado AIM was active in the Stop Newmont Mining campaign against the world's largest gold mining company. Newmont Mining was accused of exploiting indigenous peoples' lands in Peru as well as other countries around the world. Now, as Maeve Conran reports, the fight is against another mining company.
O-Martinique Silver is a Canadian mining company headquartered in Denver. They had their annual shareholders meeting last week in Colorado, and members of the Colorado American Indian Movement joined other activists to protest the company's proposed exploration in the Chalatenango region of El Salvador. The Salvadorian government issued O-Martinique a license to explore, despite local communities' opposition. Glenn Morris of Colorado AIM says there are distinct parallels between what is happening to the peasant farmers in El Salvador and what happens to Native American land in the U.S., particularly the Western Shoshone.
They're being marginalized and their communities are being threatened by another transnational corporation exploiting natural resources without the informed consent of the communities involved.
Morris was one of two proxies scheduled to appear at the shareholders' meeting on behalf of the Salvadorians. However, they were denied entry to the meeting and told their proxies were invalid. Morris and the other activists say they will continue to protest O-Martinique's development and stand in solidarity with the communities of Chalatenango. In Colorado, this is Maeve Conran for Independent Native News.
A court in British Columbia has upheld native-only fisheries. As Craig McCulloch reports, the court found it did not violate Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
The unanimous decision by the five-judge panel will allow native-only fisheries to continue harvesting Pacific salmon. In their ruling, the judges, all from the Appeals Court of British Columbia, say that a native-only commercial fishery is a legitimate political decision. The court finds it does not violate the Charter of Rights and Freedoms or the equality rights of fishing boat operators that are non-native. One of the justices, Pamela Kirkpatrick, says in the decision that even if it was discriminatory, the native-only fishery should be allowed because rights of Aboriginal Canadians are part of the Constitution. In making the decision, the court upholds convictions of 10 non-native commercial fishing boat operators who held a protest fishery in 1998. The policy to allow certain native bands to hold a commercial fishery started back in 1992 and has been a hotbed of controversy among non-native fishing interests since that time. The decision will most likely be appealed by non-native fishing boat organizations. For Independent Native News, I'm Craig McCulloch in Vancouver.
The Historical Museum on Lake Superior's Madeline Island has teamed up with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission to display an exhibit of Native American dolls. Wisconsin Public Radio's Danielle Kading reports from Superior.
The exhibit is called Small Spirits, the Crandall Collection of American Indian Dolls. Madeline Island Museum curator Steve Cotherman says the display is a special one.
This is the first time that we've partnered with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission out of Bad River to have the museum opened for members of the Ojibwe community who come to the museum around Memorial Day weekend each year for ceremonies.
Kofferman says the collection of more than 500 dolls came from the Crandall family of Wisconsin Dells. Over a span of half a century, the family collected dolls from American Indian artists. The dolls represent tribes from all over the country, made with anything from fur to clay to swamp grass. Kofferman says visitors to the museum aren't the only ones who take away something meaningful from the exhibits.
We've had lots and lots of visitors over the years from the Ojibwe people, and it's been really interesting. It's very educational for us to hear a different perspective. We learn a lot from them when they come in and say, you know, I remember the stories my grandfather told me about these kinds of things, and we learned from that. So we really welcome those encounters, those dialogues.
In Superior, Danielle Kading.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a Native venture protecting Indian Country's assets. www.amerind-corp.org.